Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
From Harrah's Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harrah's.
You're good, kid, but as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up.
Now, from the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
Coming up on the show today, we talk with a mixed games specialist by the name of Awais Ahmed, a guy who last summer added his first gold bracelet to his collection at the World Series of Poker. Also, some news about the White House's reaction to an online poker petition, and lots more stuff in poker news. Hi, I'm Paul Harrah, sitting at the feature table of the World Series of Poker Room here at Harrah's St. Louis, where the Bad Beat jackpot is up to $101,000. And yesterday, somebody won a seat into the 25K satellite for the million-dollar buy-in tournament. All I know is his first name is Jim. I don't know his last name. I'm waiting to get the paperwork here from management. But congratulations to Jim, and good luck in July when you go out to the Rio. My partner Dennis Phillips is all psyched up for a lot of stuff coming up at the Rio. The World Series of Poker starts officially this Sunday with the casino event, the casino employees event, and then Monday with the very first bracelet event. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's only 103 out here in Vegas.
Oh, it's World Series of Poker time for sure. Let's get into the air-conditioned poker rooms.
Yeah, again, the only people wearing jackets walking into the Rio will be the poker players.
Yeah. Hey, but before we talk about all the stuff for this week, I want to clarify something I said on last week's show, because we got quite a bit of response to this via Twitter. You and I were talking about somebody had asked Jack Effel, the tournament director of the WSOP, on the conference call last week, what the WSOP was going to do about the championship banner for Chris Jesus Ferguson, and whether it would be put up or taken down or covered up, and the same for Russ Hamilton, who was involved in the super user scandal at Ultimate Bet several years ago. And what Jack and his colleagues at the WSOP decided was they were going to put these up because they represented a moment of time. They were not endorsements of the people, but simply remembering that these guys did win the main event of the World Series of Poker. You and I discussed it. We both thought that was appropriate. And I said, it's like Barry Bonds and Pete Rose. Barry Bonds did hit more home runs than anyone else, and Pete Rose does have the hits record in Major League Baseball, both of which are honored in the Baseball Hall of Fame. I can't tell you how many emails and tweets we got from people saying Barry Bonds and Pete Rose are not in the Hall of Fame, which I know and which you know, but their feats, their accomplishments are in Cooperstown. There are plaques there showing Pete Rose as the all-time hits leader and Barry Bonds as the all-time home run leader. And to me, that kind of indication is the same sort of thing that you're doing at the Rio when you hang Chris Ferguson's banner and Russ Hamilton's banner. Regardless of whatever else you may think about them, we're not talking about putting these guys into the Poker Hall of Fame with Barry Greenstein and Lyndon Johnson and Doyle Brunson and Stu Unger and all the rest of the people who are in there. We're talking about representing something they accomplished, just like Bonds and Rose have had their accomplishments recognized in Cooperstown. Does that make sense?
It did to me at the time, and then I started looking at some of the notes I got, and I'm going, did I misunderstand you? No, the fact that he hit more home runs than anybody else, the fact that Pete Rose has more hits than anybody else is a record. It is represented at Cooperstown. It is in the books, and it's official. It doesn't mean that they're in the Hall of Fame or anything. Just like Russ Hamilton is never going to be in the Poker Hall of Fame.
Right.
Okay? Not going to happen.
Right.
So, you know.
Okay.
Next subject.
All right. I just wanted to clarify that. Now, I mentioned that the first real bracelet event for the WSOP is just 6 days away. Have you started to plot out your schedule for the WSOP between next Monday and July 7th when the main event starts?
I have a little bit, but it's I'm not for sure what I'm going to do, to be honest. I've got several business things going on, a lot of different changes this year. I'm involved with the photography this year at the World Series with a friend of mine by the name of Eric Hawkins. And that's going to be taking up some of my time at the beginning of it. And the other thing that you got to remember, the tournaments that are going on in Vegas, it's just unbelievable in June. Do you realize there's going to be season? Not only the Rio, the Venetian has its deep stack. The Orleans has one going on now. The Golden Nugget will have a series. Caesars is going to have a series. There's going to be the Wynn Classic. Binion's will be having one. There's so much poker going on in Vegas. It's just it's unbelievable.
And the thing about those other places is many of them will have much lower buy-ins. So if you can't afford to even buy into like a 225 deep stack event at the series, or $1,000 or $1,500 bracelet event, there are going to be places with $75 and $100 tournaments all over town.
Well, that, and also, say you're at the Rio, they only give you 3-1 on the chips, a $1,500 buy-in, you have $4,500 in chips. There's going to be an awful lot of people in the first 2, 3, 4 hours are going to be busted out of it.
Yep.
Don't despair. You can definitely go down the street and find another tournament going on, and you can play poker all weekend long.
Or you could do what I usually do, which is sit down in the cash games, which are always, always exciting and always pretty juicy. And you got plenty of places around town to choose from for that. But I do want to go back to one thing. You said you're involved with Eric Harkins from Image Masters, the company that has been doing the pictures of the players at the series for many, many years, off and on, and did it all throughout the WSOP circuit last year and this year as well. They traveled to every venue and took pictures of pretty much every player who entered a ring event, and players can always then get the picture of themselves and what may in many cases be their only opportunity to play in a big WSOP event. Maybe you're just going out for a weekend to play in a 1K or a 1500 event, and it's your first time there, and you'd like to have a way to remember that, or you ran deep in one and you want to be able to remember that, or you make a final table or whatever it is. Eric and his crew of photographers are always roaming through taking pictures of essentially everyone who's involved in these tournaments, and then you can have these photographic mementos, and Dennis's company is now involved in that, right?
That's it, exactly. Their goal is to take a picture of every single person that sits down at a ring event, not only one, but the people who run deep, when you get a big stack of chips in front of you, maybe when you're sitting next to somebody that you recognize from TV. If you make a final table, any of those things, they're going to be running up and down the aisles, snapping pictures from about noon until who knows when, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. And you'll have the opportunity then to customize what you want, to select the pictures you want, to put them in nice frames. They're doing so many things different this year. I love Eric's imagination. Right now, when you get the picture, you can put down beneath it whatever you want. WSOP event number 12. You can put down your place. You can put down what you won. You can do all sorts of things there to customize it. And they've got prints from the regular 5x7s all the way up to, I think they go to like a 44-inch square or something like that.
Like a poster size.
A poster size. But if you want a 16x20, you can get that. They've got a ton of things. And they've got another thing that I don't know how it's going to play, but I think it's awesome. Right in the rotunda, they're going to set up a table. They're going to put a bracelet there. They're going to put chips there. And they're going to put piles of money there. And you can stand behind it and hold up a couple of bundles and get your picture taken.
Cool.
And not only that, but they've got a program or some way to do it. It's going to be on a green sheet behind there.
Yeah.
And you can actually customize what you want in the background. You can have a cheering crowd in the background. You can have it look like you're on the cover of Time magazine. You can just you can go nuts with it.
Could I make it look like Liv Boree and Maria Ho are cheering for me?
Okay, we got to do things that are reasonable.
Well, that's great. So that's another added thing that you can look forward to if you're going out to the Rio this year. By the way, I'm going to be flying out there next Wednesday. We'll do next Tuesday's show live, and then Wednesday I'll fly out there, and we're taking a whole bunch of recording equipment, and we'll be set up probably at one of the Image Masters booths or maybe in the media center, and Dennis and I will be recording interviews with all sorts of poker pros and poker personalities for the next week or so, while we also play tournaments and cash games. So there's a lot of juggling going on there, but you'll be able to find all of that on our website, the new website, by the way, which is finaltableshow.com. All right, now I want to ask you about something else that's going on in Las Vegas, and that is the WPT Championship. This is the end of their season 10, $25,000 event, always held at the Bellagio. This is an event that 5 years ago was drawing 639 entrants. Last year had 220 entrants. This year, only 152 have signed up for this. Why, Dennis? Why is the number of people playing in this thing dropped off so much?
Well, they've changed the format some, and I personally don't like it. To give you an idea, on day two, 98 people started. They knocked out 30 people, and 95 people finished.
What?
Yeah. You could sign up all of day one. You could sign up all of day two. You could even sign up at the beginning of day three.
With full starting chips?
With full starting chips. You're starting, I think you would end up with 60 big blinds if you didn't sign up till the last minute.
That's still pretty good when you get in on day three, and you know, a lot of people have been eliminated from the field.
Yeah, and it's also 7 days long. Again, that's just longer than the average person wants to do it. The buy-in is higher than the average person wants to do. I think they need to relook at the structure of it.
Do you think
it's not working?
Do you think that Scoop also had something to do with it? PokerStars, of course, not available for players in the U.S., but for players in other countries, they were able to play some of these online tournaments in the Spring Championship of Online Poker on PokerStars, and, you know, the buy-ins weren't 25K, and there were lots and lots of those events. Do you think that some international players might have said, hey, or Americans who've moved to other countries might have said, you know, why go to the Bellagio for a whole week when I could play, you know, 8 or 9 different tournaments all at the same time?
Very good point, and I agree with you totally. There's a huge amount there. The other thing, they've got the Rio going on for 6, 7, 8 weeks long.
Yeah.
If you're coming from somewhere else, do you want to spend another 2 or 3 weeks in Vegas and make it a full 2.5 months? I think they need to look at the scheduling and where they have it. I think they need to look at their structure and how they're doing it. And I think this is the only tournament in the world that you can sign in on day three with a full starting stack.
Wow. Yeah, I think the WSOP coming so close on the heels of this might be a factor because of bankroll management. Again, we're not talking about the average Joe or Jane here. We're talking about people who can afford it. I mean, after all, WPT is going to have their 100K super high roller tomorrow. I don't think they'll get more than 36 people playing in that, and it'll be the usual suspects, and you might as well just give it to Eric Seidel right now. But but still, there aren't many people who have the kind of bankroll where they can afford to do the WSOP and the WPT, even through its preliminary events, and get time in Vegas. Most people are going to make one trip to Vegas for a few days. Can't afford to stay out there for the whole week unless it's the WSOP main event.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. I like the Bellagio. I like the WPT. I think they need to relook at their championship.
By the way, the World Series of Poker circuit event in New Orleans this weekend, another $1,600 main event, 694 people in that. So as we've said many times before, there are lots more people showing up to play live tournament poker, which is why I think the main event this year could have over 8,000 in it, up from the 6,600 of last year. I think we could get over 8,000 because so many more people are playing live poker in the circuit and other tournaments all over the country. But those are not these 25K and 100K events.
I agree with you on that. The other thing I think you're going to see at the series is a tremendous field in the satellite and in some of the sit-and-goes.
Oh, yeah.
People are doing a lot of money management with their roles right now. They don't want to pay $10,000 to get into an event. If they can get into it through a satellite or through a sit-and-go, they're going to do it.
Now, I want to ask you a question that we just got a little while ago from a listener on Twitter who says, I need some advice or guidance for an unknown with results to get a staking shot in the WSOP. The goal is to get a shot and do something for charity. What kind of advice do you have for somebody like that? We've talked in the past about staking being really on the downswing ever since Black Friday, but the fact that he's an unknown, what would you say to this guy, Dennis?
Not much of any encouragement. It's getting really, really hard to get stakes. A lot of the major stakers are really pulling in the horns now. There's been a lot of people burned by trying to stake people. It's going to be really, really hard to get staked.
There just isn't the money, or people are just not as open to doing it as they were in previous years?
Actually, I think both.
Yeah, I think so, too. I would say to this listener, you probably want to turn to Jungle Man for some help. Daniel Cates, who I exchanged some text messages with earlier today, tells me that he's giving away another main event seat this year. Last year he did it just by random drawing. This year he wants people to send him videos or post videos on YouTube of themselves doing good deeds. And he's going to look at all of these on June 20th. You have until then, so about 4 weeks to do this. He's going to look at all of those and choose one, and somebody's going to get not only a free $10,000 ticket to the main event, he's also going to pay for airfare and a room at the Rio and give you a free poker lesson.
Wow.
That's pretty sweet.
That's very good. And I'll tell you, that lesson, don't shortchange that. The guy knows how to play poker.
Yes, he does. Absolutely. Anyway, if you want to find out about that, you can just Google Jungle Man or look for him online. You'll be able to find out all the details if you want to go for that. Now, I mentioned at the top of the show that there's a little bit more news in the online poker realm. Two things I want to mention. One of them is that the White House has posted a response to an online poker petition. This has been out there for many, many months. People wanting the White House to take an official position on licensing and regulating and legalizing online poker in the United States. So there was a post on the White House website by Brian Deese, who's the Deputy Director of the National Economic Council. And this is a lot of political double talk here, but I'll just read you some of it. The administration understands that many Americans engage in paid online poker games for entertainment purposes. Online gambling on sporting events or contests violates federal law. The legality of other forms of online gambling is dependent upon the law of the states where the bettor or gambling business is located. It is left to each state to determine whether it wishes to permit such activity, blah, blah, blah. Then it goes on to the next paragraph. The rapid and anonymous nature of the Internet distinguishes online games from on-site games, such as those in casinos, and creates distinct challenges. For example, there are many means of technologically circumventing restrictions on online gambling that can allow individuals from countries where gambling is illegal or even minors to play using real currency. Online games also have greater potential for fraud because gambling websites are much cheaper and easier to establish than on-site locations, and like telemarketing scams, can appear and disappear overnight. That's a shortened version of what this guy posted as the official Obama administration response to this online poker petition. Does this make you feel better or worse?
I don't think it's worth the paper it was written on. It's not a response. The social conscience amendments that they tried to put on federal bills would directly address the minors playing on there, the locations, regulatory, making sure that the sites are following good ethics. All sorts of things like that can be handled, but it needs to be handled on a federal level.
In other words, all of those things that he mentions as concerns in the second paragraph, that's what licensing and regulating legislation would deal with.
Thank you. That's exactly it. That's their job. Do it.
Now, what about that first paragraph where he says it's left to each state to determine whether it wishes to permit such activity? Do you think this is the administration essentially saying to the states, we're not going to stop you. If you want to do this on an intrastate basis, go ahead. The ball's in your court.
After the reversal of the DOJ's opinion of the WIRE Act, I don't think they have a choice. If a state wants to go ahead and do it, i.e. Nevada or New Jersey or maybe even Illinois, I don't think the federal government can stop them.
Dennis mentions Illinois because the state Senate president there, John Cullerton, last week introduced legislation to expand the ability of the Illinois Lottery to offer other forms of online gaming. They were the ones who were the first to jump on the WIRE Act ruling and started doing internet purchases of lottery tickets. Cullerton now wants the lottery board or some state lottery organization to be able to offer online gaming, perhaps including online poker, which means, and by the way, there are only 9 days left in the legislative session, so it would have to be done very, very quickly if it were going to get done this year. But that leads to my next question for you, Dennis. Do we want a state running an online poker site?
Well, there's two schools of thought here. If you start doing it state by state, similar to what they did for the lottery, and they start putting comprises together and groups of states together, and it could actually grow to be more or less a national site. The other thing of it is, if the federal government looks at the states, looks at the revenue that they're bringing in, and sees that it can be regulated and governed and safe for the players, then perhaps they would step in on a national level and do something. So there's always a hope for that. My personal opinion is, if you do it state by state, you'll run into a lot of complications. You're not going to have the player base in many states to substantiate it. And you're going to have different rules as you go from state to state to state, and it's going to be a nightmare. The federal government needs to step in and do their job. That's it.
Yep. I would say to the question of whether we want the state to do it as opposed to a private company, whether it's Caesars or MGM or if PokerStars were ever allowed back in the United States or somebody else, my answer to that would be, have you not heard us talking about the Missouri Gaming Commission and the problems we have with them? Do you want those people to run online poker?
All the stories I could tell.
One other online poker-related question from a listener by the name of Charlie. Charlie says he keeps hearing Sheldon Adelson, who is the chairman of Las Vegas Sands, which makes pretty good dollars in Las Vegas and huge dollars in Macau, and was the bankroll guy behind Newt Gingrich's campaign. He has spoken out several times against legalizing online poker. He says that he's morally opposed to it. Charlie says, since that's Adelson's stance, and Adelson owns the Venetian, should people who want to play online poker boycott the Venetian?
Well, I can't agree with that. Number one, what Adelson is saying is that until he has proven to his satisfaction that it will be safe for the players and those social conscious items we talked about, the underage people and such, are taken care of, he cannot support any kind of an online poker system. Now, then, if you prove to him that you can regulate, that you can govern it, that you can avoid these problems, you know, I think he could change his tune. I also think that once he realizes the amount of money that he can make on this, he'll change his tune.
Yeah. You know, he's worried. I think it comes down to dollars and nothing else. I don't think the morality is really part of this. I think he sees it as a threat to his bottom line if he can't get in on it.
That could well be. And as we've seen in the past, he doesn't always make the wisest decision, i.e. Newt Gingrich.
That's very, very true. Okay, speaking of poor money decisions, you may remember we told you a story several months ago about a guy named Bradley Ruderman. Bradley Ruderman is in jail right now, serving felony time for a Ponzi scheme he ran with an investment advisor, essentially con game that he was running. He ripped off investors for something like $25 million. Why would we tell you that on a poker show? Well, he ended up playing in some high-stakes private poker games with some well-known Hollywood celebrities. Tobey Maguire was involved in the game. Gabe Kaplan was involved in the game. Nick Cassavetes, the writer-director, was in the game. Although they were never named in the lawsuit, we understand that people like Matt Damon and Ben Affleck and other poker-playing Hollywood celebrities would go to this game, quite often held at some fancy hotel where they'd get a suite and they'd play and, you know, there'd be food and drink and all sorts of other stuff and a huge rake for the people who were running the games. It wasn't the running of the games that got them in trouble. It was the fact that Bradley Ruderman was losing money to these Hollywood celebrities. So after there was a bankruptcy declared by some of the people who he ripped off, they went to court and got a trustee to represent them, and the bankruptcy trustee sued those other Hollywood celebs who played poker with and took money from Bradley Ruderman at the poker table to the tune of something like $5 million. Now, we speculated on this show whether this would ever go to court. Dennis was absolutely right in his prediction that it would not, because just a couple of days ago, 22 of these Hollywood celebrities settled this case out of court for $1.75 million. Sounds like a lot of money until you do the division. That's about $80,000 each, which was probably about one pot in this game they were playing. I mean, they were playing like 100, 200, no limit, sometimes 500 and 1,000, no limit in these high-stakes celebrity private games. So for $80,000 each, they're essentially off the hook. So a good call by you, and probably a good call by these poker-playing celebrities, right? To settle it?
I absolutely think so. It eliminates it. The argument was that he was playing with other people's money,
yep,
that it wasn't his money to lose. And you're talking about life saving of some people. So you have people that can play in these stakes and can afford to lose $80,000 versus somebody who could now maybe forced to lose their house.
Yep.
You need to settle it.
Now, I actually think there's a bit of bad news in this. The bad news is we're not going to get details about the game. I want to know who played, how much did they, what were they sitting down at the table with, what kind of stakes were they really playing, who won, who lost. I want to know those kind of details, but I guess that's why the word private was attached to the games, right?
Absolutely, and I've played with several of the people on that list, and I think Gabe Kaplan probably loved that game.
I think he probably did. Yeah, and Tobey Maguire, damn good poker player. You know, a lot of guys, pretty damn good poker players.
Matt Affleck, very good player.
Matt Damon and Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck.
Yeah,
he
won the California State Poker Championship 5 or 6 years ago.
Absolutely.
Okay, this weekend is another chance for you to win yourself a main event seat this summer at the WSOP, courtesy of this casino. Our sponsor, Harrah's St. Louis. They're going to be doing the double shootout qualifiers again Saturday and Sunday at noon and 3. We're getting down to your last chance here, folks, because we're at the end of May. You want to come this weekend and play in these, because if you win the seat, this is how Dennis got there in 2008. This is how I'm going to be playing in the main event this year, by winning it exactly this way. Then you'll have time to be able to make your travel plans, etc. You get the $10,000 seat plus $1,000 travel money, or whatever you want to do with it, money. All you got to do is win your table to go to the final table. Then you win that, and you've got the prize. You got to beat 18 people for a $200 investment and $11,000 prize. Details are on the website, harrahs.com/STLPoker. It'll be this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, here in the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris, taking a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Owais Ahmed, bracelet winner last summer, specialist in mixed games, which we don't get to talk about all that often on this show, but we'll do it when we come back in a moment here on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com and our podcasts on FinalTableShow.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Get our podcasts on FinalTableShow.com or listen for our rebroadcasts on Wednesday evenings on Hold'emRadio.com. We're also available via iTunes and Stitcher Radio, so you can download it to your smartphone wherever you are, whether it's an Apple or an Android phone. You can always have connections with the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Our guest today is Owais Ahmed, a mixed game specialist who made three final tables at the LA Poker Classic earlier this year. Last summer at the WSOP, he had deep runs in five events, including his first bracelet, winning the $2,500 limit Omaha Stud 8 or Better event, and also a fourth place finish in the 50K Poker Players Championship. He's also been doing some commentary work with Bart Hansen and Dave Tuckman on the Live at the Bike webcast. So, Owais, welcome to the Final Table.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I want to start with the Live at the Bike webcast because that's actually where I first heard you. I had seen you play, but I'd never heard you doing commentary, and I heard you on there with Bart a few weeks ago, and I thought you did a terrific job. Having Dennis and I have both been on Live at the Bike as players, I'm curious for you being in the booth whether doing that commentary has helped your game.
I think anytime you study poker hands, it helps your game. Live at the Bike definitely helps me improve my game just by, as you commentate, you think out poker situations because you want to express, like, different viewpoints for your viewers. And the more you think about the game, the more it's going to, I guess, just advance in your mind. And I'll say there are definitely some players, when they play on the show, that will help me improve my game more than others because sometimes we do have very good games with very live players sometimes on the show, and it makes for a great show, too.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I liked playing that. I enjoyed it. Question for you. You said it helps your hand or it helps your poker playing when you're analyzing the hands and such. Is that a good or a bad thing? Does it help because you see new ways to play it, new twists, new interesting aspects of it, or you look at it and say, there's not a chance in the world that I'm going to play the hand the way he did?
sometimes it's from column A and sometimes it's from column B. but anytime you have the ability to look at a hand and say, oh, wow, maybe I could play this differently, or if this player had done this, the hand would have been totally different. That's a sense of enlightenment and something you can think about towards your own game and perhaps institute it somewhere along the line.
I mentioned when I introduced you that you're a mixed game specialist. You play a lot of Omaha Stud 8 kind of games, which is where you got your bracelet last summer. How does a player in the environment where everybody's playing No Limit Hold'em and some people are playing PLO, where can a player even go to practice for a mixed game tourney?
Well, I'm sure at all the local casinos they have some sort of Omaha 8 game running. Omaha 8, I'd say out of the mixed games, is one of the more popular ones. Stud 8's definitely tougher to come by. There's also online play, which I know is mostly banned in the U.S., but I believe Merge Poker does have some Omaha 8 games that do run. It's definitely tougher to get practice right now than it was a couple years ago, but if you really want to, there are places available.
Well, I noticed this year you've got like half a dozen caches already, but they're on Omaha 8, they're on the stud, they're in an all-inner fold, a deuce of seven triple draw, which I love that game, or at the Commerce you played in an eight-game mix and cashed in that one. Do you specifically look for games like this because you think that's a weaker or a better buy-in for you?
I generally don't travel for a lot of tournaments. And when a tournament series is running in L.A., I'm really not interested in playing a $300 or $500 no-limit event. But I'll play a mixed game event because, one, I enjoy mixed games a lot more than I do no-limit. And the other is my edge in those games is much, much higher than it is in no-limit. I think a key concept to illustrate this point is nowadays in no-limit hold'em, I'd say the majority of players are educated enough where when you have 15 big blinds or 10 big blinds, you know what to do. It's very optimal play. There are hand charts out there that state, look, this is game theory optimal, this is what you should do, and shove and fold charts. Whereas when you have five or six big bets in triple draw, for example, do you know exactly what hand ranges you should be playing? I feel a lot of players don't know this, which is where edges come from in those games.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
During the LAPC, Commerce is my local casino, so I played a lot of these mixed tournaments because it's also important to support local poker tournaments in your area. I knew that one more body in the no-limit tournaments at Commerce wouldn't mean much, but for example, the triple draw tournament only got about 80 players. The mixed game tournament at Commerce got maybe 50 players. So just being there and supporting these tournaments and supporting Matt Savage as well, he's a great tournament director, and he makes great tournament structures, was also important.
Well, to kind of follow up on that, do you think that pretty much variance is the word I'm going to use, on no limit has been solved by so many people that there aren't very many weak people at a tournament anymore, and everybody, you know, knows how to play, like you said, when they get close to, you know, 8 or 10 big blinds or a 5M factor or whatever it happens to be. Is like the deuce of seven triple draw what no limit used to be 10 years ago when you always had the weak people at the table you could pick on?
Yeah, I'd definitely say that. I'd say mixed tournaments are where no-limit tournaments were 10 years ago. And the ROI of a mixed-game tournament specialist is going to be much higher than the ROI of a no-limit hold'em tournament specialist. The converse to that is there aren't that many mixed-game tournaments, there aren't that many big mixed-game tournaments, and all the big money is in no-limit. But there definitely are always going to be weak players in no-limit tournaments, and there definitely always will be edges. It's just not as big as it used to be.
Dennis mentioned that you played the All-In or Fold tournament at the LAPC back in February. Please tell him. We've joked about this. We even asked Matt Savage about it. We haven't had a chance to talk to somebody who actually sat down and played it. So tell us about that experience.
Well, it was right after I busted in the OE tournament. I think I got fifth or sixth in that. So and OE is at, what I won my bracelet in. So I was really hoping to close out this tournament and win it. And I ran a little bit bad on the final table, so I busted fifth or sixth place. And so here I am right off my final table. I go downstairs and look at the cash game list. So I get on the list, and it seemed like it'd be at least an hour before I get a seat because some of the games are just so good that you can get locked out because no one leaves. And so this $120 All-In or Fold tournament was running, and I think it had already been running for an hour. So I said to myself, well, I'm not going to be doing anything for another hour. Let's just go and flip. And right before I was about to sit down, I ran to a poker buddy of mine. His name's Chris Swan. He's someone that plays a lot of these types of tournaments. He plays a lot of the $300, $500 tournaments, and he's very successful at them. And I said, hey, I'm going to play the All-In or Fold tournament. Have any advice for me? He said, look, every decision in the tournament is all ICM-based. And just look at your hand value, chip stack, blinds, and just judge it by ICM. And that's how you play the tournament optimally.
All right, well, I got to stop you for a second because you got to explain what is ICM.
ICM is the independent chip model, and it's this model that has come about where you look at your chip stack, you look at the size of the pot, and you look at how much you have to gain money-wise or value-wise in a tournament when you go all in, essentially, or when you make a decision, but in this case, when you go all in or if you fold. For example, if I have 1,000 big blinds and I'm under the gun with pocket nines in an all-in or fold tournament, I shouldn't be folding because I have my stack so big. However, if I have 8 big blinds, it's an all-in because the blinds are going to be coming through me and I need to get in there and gamble more because the odds of me surviving are much, much less. So that's an extreme example of how ICM will affect your decision.
Okay, so he tells you that that's the strategy to use, and after you hear him tell you that, what do?
I play exactly to what I would consider appropriate ICM decisions. Basically, my under-the-gun all-in was ace-king and jacks, pocket jacks plus, and even on the button, I was folding, like ace-8 offsuit. When it's folded to me, I'm on the button, I have 30 big blinds. You know, to risk 30 big blinds to win 1.5 big blinds with ace-8 offsuit isn't really an appropriate ICM decision because the times my chip stack increases isn't worth the time I go out or get dominated. So I just played it appropriately towards ICM, which really gears towards a tighter set of play when you're playing with over 20 big blinds in this situation.
Well, they got all in or fold. They have all sorts of new games coming out. They changed several of them in the WSOP this year. Is there any in particular you like when they go from a full ring down to a six max to a heads up, or the position game that the Bellagio's been playing over there, where you win the position, you win the button. Anything new twists that you really like or dislike in the game?
Yeah, I saw that at the World Series there's an ante-only tournament. I think that
there you go.
I think that's going to be a great tournament. I might actually end up playing that one. I just noticed it on the schedule the other day, and I think the position game, the buy the button, win the dealer game, I think that can be something that'll catch on. I think it's something that's geared towards the more aggressive game of players, and anytime you add a new variation into poker, in comes a new strategy, in comes a new skill in learning that strategy and instituting that strategy. And I'm always for new variations of the game because it also makes it more fun. Doing the same game every time does get a little tedious and boring at times.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris at Harris St. Louis with our guest, Owais Ahmed, bracelet winner last summer at the WSOP, also made the final table of the 50K Poker Players Championship. In the event where you won the bracelet, the 2500 OE event, that's Limit Omaha Stud 8 or better, for listeners who don't know what OE stands for, you defeated the grinder, Michael Mizrachi, heads up, to win the bracelet. But when you got to heads up, he had a massive chip lead on you. Now, anybody who plays No Limit knows that can flip any time. You know, you could double through somebody a couple of times, and now you're the massive chip leader. How do you do that in a limit tournament? Unless the blinds are tremendously high at that point, what's the strategy, and how did you accomplish that?
Great question. Well, for one thing, the betting limit had reached a high amount. I believe it was 50,000, 100,000. So that's 50,000 for the small bet on the small bet streets and 100,000 on the big bet streets, which would be the turn and the river.
Yep.
And I think I had a 1.1 million chip stack, which is only 11 big bets, But if you look at it in terms of blinds, it's 25K/50K blinds. So I have over 20 big blinds. And anytime you have over 20 big blinds in poker, you have the ability to hand select. It's not, I'm just going to get it all in and try to get lucky. So I picked my spots. Obviously, I had to have gotten a couple of good hands, maybe more than a couple, to beat Michael out of some pots. But I had an image that I used. I'd been playing tighter on the final table and leading up to the final table. So I started loosening up and randomizing and bluffs into my play, which worked pretty well. I remember specifically one bluff I ran. I had 3, 4, 5, 6 in my hand. Michael raised. I called from the big blind. Flop came Qu9-3. I check called his bet because he was just firing away on any flop. And the turn came a 9. So the board's now Qu9-3-9. And I checked too many bets, and I check raise him. And I planned on check raising a lot of turns if I two paired up, if I tripped up, or turns that I thought hurt his hand. And I didn't think a 9 helped him very much. And he sat there and thought for a while, and he folds ace queen face up. And at that point, I knew that that was the first bluff that I tried to run on him. And at that point, I knew I got him, where he was falling into exactly what I wanted him to think. And when you have a player that does exactly what you want to think and heads up poker, at that point it's just a matter of executing. And after that hand, that I believe was a pivotal hand in the heads up match. After that, I just executed my game plan. I bluffed him a couple other times, and at that point I had him on the ropes. His physical demeanor went from being very strong and in the zone to more of a slump back, and he started scratching his head a lot. And it took about an hour to get to that point in the heads-up match. But when it did, it gave me more confidence, and I was able to close him out.
Well, I've played against the grinder a number of times. Let me tell you, when he gets a chip lead or thinks he has an advantage over you, he's going to hammer you. And I think that's probably what he tried to do to you. And you were able to take advantage of that, you know, because obviously when you check raise him, he's going to put you on a decent hand of some sort. So I think you played it very well.
Thank you. So, yeah, he definitely tried to hammer me, and it was working for him throughout the final table. He had no reason to believe it wouldn't work. It just so happened that I was able to pick up on certain spots where he was trying to hammer me that I felt he was weak. And he wasn't sure if I was capable of running bluffs on him. Also, at the same time, he obviously probably didn't get as many good cards as I did. In a heads-up match, we're talking about maybe 50, 60 hands. So throughout a period of 50 or 60 hands, one player is definitely going to be getting better cards. So strategy plus maybe a little bit of run good, too.
Yeah.
I'll give you one word of warning. I know Michael well enough. You probably won't be able to do that the second time against him if you get heads up with him again.
Yeah.
He's a good player.
So yeah, he's a great player.
So you won the bracelet in that event, and I mentioned you also made the final table of the 50K Poker Players Championship. You ended up fourth there last year. This year's Poker Players Championship won't be televised. It's not going to be on ESPN, which means that the final table won't have to be only No Limit Hold'em. They'll be able to keep it the 8-game mix. Do you think that's good, and are you planning on playing again?
Well, one, I am planning on playing again. Secondly, I think that having the final table on ESPN is a great experience. It's definitely one of those once-in-a-lifetime experiences. It also had the ability to bring a lot of poker players that aren't as well-known into the limelight, onto ESPN. I believe that show got a 2.1 million rating the first time it aired. And you look at the people that got it deep in that tournament. It was someone like Mack Lance, someone like Min Lai. These are people that are well-known in the poker community but aren't well-known on TV because they don't travel around and play a lot of these events on the circuit. Instead, they sit there and grind cash games, and they're some of the most successful players in the world and some of the best. because they know the value is in cash games and therefore don't get on TV as much. So that tournament specifically had the ability to bring players like that onto TV. But now that it's off of TV, maintaining the structure of the tournament as a mixed tournament is important because it brings validity to what the tournament is all about. The EV of sacrificing a mixed format for being on ESPN was fair and worth it. But now that ESPN's gone, we should keep the tournament as a mixed game tournament. Otherwise, why wouldn't we change all tournaments into just no limit final tables? It doesn't make sense unless there's a TV element involved.
And by the way, I should add that after Oase went out in fourth place, Ming Lee went out in third place, and then Brian Rass defeated Phil Hellmuth heads up. After Phil went crazy, I thought, after playing incredibly solid poker up until that point. We talked to Phil about it, and he even admitted he made a couple of fatal mistakes there towards the end. But that was a heck of a final table that you were at, and congratulations on that incredible deep run.
Thank you. Yeah, I was surprised. I really thought Phil was going to win it. I thought going into the heads-up match, he had a huge psychological edge on Brian, and he was able to bluff him in certain spots. And he really had Brian on the ropes. And Brian got lucky in some coin flip hands, and that really changed the momentum. Just because a player gets lucky in a coin flip hand doesn't mean you can't keep doing to what you've been doing before. So I thought Phil's biggest mistake was he started changing up his own game plan because I believe Phil himself was slightly tilted by not closing Brian out. And that's really what cost him in the end.
Quick question for you. I'm going to be playing in the main event. Paul is going to be out there. He's won a satellite and will be out there playing in the main event this year. For Paul and for the rest of our listeners, can you give us some words of wisdom on how to prepare for it, how you should go into it, especially if it's your first main event at the WSOP?
Well, I think your best year for that, Dennis, having the great success in the main event out of all three of us. But if I was to give some advice to listeners, it would be don't be afraid and go and just play your game. The main event isn't something that should be that intimidating. There's so many players, and I'll say that 95% of the people in the main event are recreational players that are just like you. They're there to try to win the bracelet, but furthermore have the experience. Playing the main event is more of a life experience that you can enjoy. And sure, when you get deeper and the money becomes real, that's really where the game becomes more serious. But until then, just play your game and don't be afraid. The main event isn't what it once was. Back in the day, it used to be the 10 greatest players in poker, the 30 greatest players in poker playing this one tournament. Now it's more of a tourist attraction. So if you are on edge about whether or not you should try to play the main event, or earlier I heard you guys talking about this $200 satellite, go and do it. Go and try to take your shot, because you never know how the cards are going to fall. Dennis can attest to this. 1 week can change your life. And
it did,
you can't,
absolutely.
You don't have that ability in a lot of mediums, but the main event at the World Series of Poker does give you that ability.
I think that's great advice, Oase, and a great way for us to end it today. Thank you so much for joining us. We will certainly run into you at the Rio. We'll look over at every mixed game final table and probably see you there, I hope, a couple of times in the course of the summer. Good luck with all of that, and thanks so much for your time today. Oase Ahmed, mixed game specialist, joining us here on the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Dennis, I'll see you next week for our final live show before the WSOP kicks off, although you're going to play Monday's first bracelet event. So I hope by the time we talk on Tuesday, you're already into day two.
That would be cool if that happens.
Sure would. Until then, I'm Paul Harris in St. Louis. He's Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. We'll meet you back here next Tuesday at 3 for the live show on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. And don't forget, our podcasts are on our new website, FinalTableShow.com, or available via Stitcher Radio and iTunes.